Despite coronavirus fears, Illinois went ahead with the primary election yesterday. We'll recap the results. And with COVID-19 cases increasing, public health officials are encouraging patients to stock up on their prescriptions in case they can't get to a pharmacy. We'll revisit a conversation about the long hours pharmacists work and why they're asking for more breaks to prevent errors. Plus, recreational weed became legal in the state this year, and some historians are seeing parallels between legalization and the end of alcohol prohibition.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
It's all coming up next on the 21st. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Many of you have spoken at the polls. So what's next? On Tuesday, nearly 2 million Illinois voters weighed in on the presidency, U.S. Senate, U.S. House, and other races. But concerns about the coronavirus loomed large. Yesterday, Governor J.B. Pritzker announced a Chicago woman in her 60s with an underlying health condition became the first person to succumb to COVID-19. Fears of the disease spreading caused election judges across the state to stay home. Still, Illinois helped to widen former Vice President Joe Biden's lead over Bernie Sanders for the Democratic presidential nomination. Biden bested Sanders 59-36%. The only county that Sanders won in the entire state was Champaign County. In comparison, Sanders won the majority of Illinois counties back in 2016. President Donald Trump beat businessman Roque De La Fuente 96-4% and secured the Republican nomination for president. But what about the downstate ballots, and how much did the coronavirus concerns play a role in the primary? Joining us on the line, Brian Mackey, State House reporter for Illinois Public Radio. Hello, Brian.
Hey, Reginald. How are you?
I'm great. And also Jim Meadows is the senior reporter for WILL's Illinois Newsroom. He spoke with winners in the 13th and 15th congressional district primary races last night. Both may garner national attention in the months ahead. Welcome back, Jim.
Thank you, Reginald.
And we're also practicing our physical distancing, so I know I'm talking to both of you in remote locations. Brian, let me start with you. Bernie won big against Hillary in 2016, but an entirely different picture last night.
Yeah, it certainly was. I went back and pulled some of the numbers from 2016, and it's worth remembering that was a really close race. Bernie almost won. Clinton seemed to be doing well, kind of a very slow climb to the nomination, which of course is what eventually happened, but she only beat Bernie Sanders by 2 points. Back in 2016. Quite a different story this year. Joe Biden defeating Sanders by 23 points. So just a resounding victory. But the numbers tell a lot of that story. So Clinton and Sanders both got about a million votes. Biden, so that's 2 million votes cast in the Democratic contest for president back in 2016. This year, Biden got just over 900,000 votes so far. Bernie got a little more than 500,000. So the turnout was just significantly lower. Now, a big caveat there is that in Chicago, where there have been a number of election mishaps leading up to this unprecedented election amid a global pandemic, they announced late on election day, that there were going to be 200,000 early voting ballots that had not yet been counted, and a potential universe, is how they phrase that, of another 70,000 mail-in ballots. They're going to be coming in the next 2 weeks. Now, you do the math on that, it would not be enough to, you know, even if every single one of those votes went for Bernie Sanders, it would not be enough to change the outcome of that race. But there are a number of local elections in Chicago that could be affected by that.
Interesting. U.S. Senator Dick Durbin is seeking a fifth term to represent Illinois. He is a Democrat. Who is the Republican challenging him?
Yeah, there was, even though Durbin has won with, and the Board of Elections website was a little hinky yesterday, I got probably a lot of demands on it. I couldn't go back and find his margins of victory, but he's won pretty comfortably in most of his recent elections. And so it's not an election that, on the Republican side, that drew a lot of big names, not a lot of people willing to give up, you know, their existing seats in power to take on this daunting challenge of a fairly entrenched, as you said, somebody who's seeking his fifth term in the U.S. Senate, Dick Durbin. But the Republican winner was the former Lake County Sheriff named Mark Curran. He is won fairly handily a decent plurality of the vote. He campaigned on being pro-life, pro-tighter border control, pro-Second Amendment rights, pro-Constitution, everything you would expect a Republican in the Trump era to campaign on. But he does have, and some of his opponents tried to use this against him, he does have some, you know, record of some moderate stances or working across the aisle in the past. He was a supporter, for example, which a lot of Illinois Republicans were, I believe, of the temporary visitor driver's license, which basically was a way to get people who are in Illinois without, legal status, being able to have driver's licenses so then they could get insurance. It was billed as kind of a public safety move at the time, but as the Republican Party has moved further to the right on immigration issues, that has become something of a liability for him. But he is the nominee, and he will be challenging Dick Durbin this fall.
Not a lot of surprises in the presidential or Senate primary contest, but get ready for some fireworks in some of the congressional races. WILL senior reporter Jim Meadows, let me turn to you. Republican Rodney Davis won the 13th congressional district race in 2018. I understand he'll be competing in November against a familiar face.
Yes, Reginald, he'll be competing against Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, who came within a percentage point of defeating Davis in 2018, and Lonergan easily defeated her primary challenger, Stephanie Smith, in yesterday's primary. So the two will be back on the ballot again in November.
And this could be an expensive race.
Well, for those figures, I'm looking at reporting that Ryan Denham has done over at WGLT in Normal. And just noting that already the money raised has gotten into over $1 million for both candidates for 2020. Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan has raised $1.4 million so far. Davis has raised $1.9 million. Londrigan actually outraised Davis in 2018, although it was not enough to defeat him.
And she lost by just a very small margin, right?
Yes, and this is in a district, and one reason I think that there's so much money being spent here is that this district was drawn by a Democratic legislature in Illinois so that a Democrat would have a chance at winning. And over the past decade, there have been several election years in which Democrats have made a really hard try to defeat the Republican.
Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan talked with you, Jim, last night, and she talked about the ongoing coronavirus crisis. Let's listen to what she said.
You know, making sure that people have access to quality, affordable health care is, you know, why I got into this race in the first place. And, you know, I'll be watching very closely because I want to see how Congress is going to help working families make it through this crisis.
And we need to mention Congressman Davis supports a relief bill that has passed the House and expected to pass in the Senate. And it would include paid sick and family leave for some workers, extended unemployment benefits, and emergency funds for food security programs. Jim, can we expect health care to be a big talking point for both Londrigan and Davis?
Well, yes, because healthcare has been a big talking point for both of these candidates. Both Davis and Lonergan are in the situation of having had family members who have faced serious illness. In the case of Lonergan, it was his son who was, I think, infected with Rocky Mountain spotted fever because of a tick bite. And in Davis's case, because his wife suffered from colon cancer, these were real serious illnesses that that afflicted family members of both of the candidates, and both of them has used them as a show of how sincere they are about wanting to get a good solution about health care in the nation.
And I think anyone who hasn't thought about those health care issues or, you know, made them major issues, maybe thinking about them with the coronavirus right now. Let's talk now with Brian Mackey. You know, back in 2018, Democrat Sean Casten flipped the 6th congressional district from red to blue, and Lauren Underwood did the same in the 14th. But I take it the Republicans are going to fight for those districts again.
Yeah, these are, you know, anytime there's a wave election, the other party is eyeing the races that it thinks it might be able to win back. And these were two that in the 2018 blue wave, where the Democrats swept back into power in the U.S. House of Representatives with such big consequences, right? I mean, we've had impeachment as a result of that. These are two seats that Republicans think they'll be able to win. And so they, you know, they're drew at least in the Lauren Underwood district, in the 15th, which is sort of the exurban area, if you will. It's just beyond, it's the far western suburbs and even beyond the suburbs until, at least until Chicagoland merges with Iowa City someday in one giant metropolis. But, or I should say Des Moines. Oh, that joke flopped, didn't it? The race there drew a number of Republicans. The biggest name was State Senator Jim Oberweis. He is a state senator, but he has even greater name recognition than that because, of course, he runs Oberweis Dairy, which is all over Chicagoland and the suburbs as a series of milk and ice cream stores. People have home delivery of the milk. He's also run for governor and U.S. Senate statewide before. So he won that primary, and he will be challenging current U.S. Representative Lauren Underwood, who was one of the surprise winners in 2018. This is thought to be a very Republican area. I mean, Democrats knew it was competitive, but I mean, this is where former Speaker of the House Denny Hastert was from. So it's something that Republicans have their eye on. And then similarly, in Sean Casten's district, in a slightly closer northwest suburbs of Chicago, State Representative Jeannie Ives, who also was the more famous candidate in that race, she almost defeated then incumbent Republican Governor Bruce Rauner in the Republican primary 2 years ago, developed a lot of name recognition there. She has a lot of credibility as a very staunch conservative in the Illinois House of Representatives. She chose a very moderate tone, and this is such an interesting thing. I know, you know, Jim talked to Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan from home, and most of these candidates did not have big parties or really any sorts of public events. They had somebody pull out a smartphone or camera or something and film a little video of them on Facebook Live. Ives's was, you know, she was sitting at a desk. It was almost like sort of a, you know, doing a mock-up of the presidential scene, and she delivered a very, you know, pre-written address into the camera and struck a very bipartisan tone, said, you know, as we're dealing with this coronavirus crisis, we need to, you know, focus on real solutions for Illinois. And she praised Governor Pritzker for going ahead with the election, because there has been some finger-pointing and questions about whether that was the right decision, although Pritzker points out that he doesn't have the authority to unilaterally cancel an election. That would take action from the General Assembly. But I digress. Anyway, 15th District and the 8th Congressional District, both in the Chicago area, are something that are expected to get national attention and national money as Democrats try to hold on to those seats they gained 2 years ago.
And I want to clarify, Lauren's in the 14th, correct?
Oh, so, thank you. Yes, yes. So I don't like using numbers.
Now let's talk quickly about the 15th. We've got just about 3.5 minutes left. And it looks like Republican Mary Miller will take on Democrat Erica Weaver. This is a district where John Shimkus is retiring, a huge district encompassing central and southern Illinois, a land area larger than the state of Maryland. Real quickly, Jim, what can you tell us about Mary and Erica?
Well, Mary Miller is a first-time candidate, but she is well-connected. She is married to State Representative Chris Miller, and she has picked up endorsements with the House Freedom Caucus, with their PAC organization, and also personal endorsements from several congressional leaders with them. Erica Weaver ran a race with very little money. She is a public defender in Coles County. She serves on the school board in Mattoon. She's also a first-time candidate, also the only African-American in among the eight candidates who ran in the 15th district in the two primaries.
And both of them defeated, you know, a field of four men. They had three men both of them defended, beat three men in both of their races, correct?
That is the case. Weaver in the case with really not much organization at all, although I'd say none of the Democratic candidates in the 15th had much organization. Miller had, I think, probably the best organization, and she had, I think, more campaign money just for the primary than all of the other candidates in both parties.
And Jim, quickly, tell me why these either winner, Mary Miller or Erica Weaver, could be a one-time member of Congress.
A one-time member of Congress because redistricting is coming, of course, with the 2020 census. So the next race will be run on a new district map. Illinois is losing population and is expected to lose a congressional seat, so there will only be 17 districts instead of 18. Whoever is the 15th district Congress member, who frankly is probably going to be a Republican, may find themselves in a new district with another incumbent there as well.
Interesting. Well, real quickly, Brian, we got 30 seconds left. I mean, we could see, because of COVID-19, really the race going forward being really different.
Yeah, I mean, there are questions right now about whether there will be political conventions. I heard some national reporters on NPR last night saying, we don't know when the next primary will actually be. So this is definitely something that none of us has ever lived through in terms of covering a presidential election. And it's going to be fascinating and frightening and something that we'll just have to see what happens.
Well, we've been talking with Illinois State House reporter Brian Mackey and WILL senior reporter Jim Meadows about this week's Illinois primary, with a cloud of the coronavirus hanging over it. Thank you both for joining us remotely.
Good to be with you.
You're welcome.
And you are listening to The 21st. I'm Reginald Hardwick. We'll have more in just a moment. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Healthcare workers around the country have been on the front lines of the coronavirus outbreak, working long hours and coming up with plans for how they'll respond to an increase in COVID-19 patients. Pharmacists have also been busy, as health officials have encouraged patients to stock up on at least a month's worth of their prescriptions should they be unable to get to a pharmacy. But even before the coronavirus, pharmacists were pulling long shifts on their feet with no guaranteed breaks. We thought today would be a good time to revisit a conversation we had back in November about a Chicago Tribune investigation that found pharmacists working long hours were more likely to make mistakes that could lead to dangerous drug interactions. Christine Herman spoke with Chicago Tribune reporter Ray Long and Dr. Lakeisha Butler, a clinical associate professor of pharmacy at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. Here's that interview.
Ray, let's start with you. Can you take us back to the Tribune investigation in 2016? How did the story come about?
Well, a couple of the reporters had been working on the idea of drug interactions being a problem. And Sam Rowe, had gone to New York and worked with the university out there and a hospital out there and did a big data run and found combinations of drugs that actually altered people's heart rates. And these were drugs that were unknown to doctors or the general physician world overall. And so that was a piece of the equation. Another reporter, Carissa King, had done a story about how people can be impacted by this. She wrote about a woman who became blind and her skin was peeling, et cetera, all because she had a dangerous combination of drugs that were prescribed to her and given to her, and how she had to struggle to overcome that. And so at that point, I was brought in to help pull together a story where we would put two prescriptions of drugs that were viewed as fairly well-known combinations that should be catchable by pharmacists if they were placed next to each other. And what we did was we asked a doctor here in Chicago, Dr. Fox, to go and prescribe these for us. And he knowing that it was a study and not something that we were trying to scam, gave us the prescriptions and placed them, and we took them around and placed them side by side, and pharmacists filled them 52% of the time.
Wow.
In other words, combinations that could kill somebody, could harm
yeah.
somebody.
What were those drugs specifically that you used in this like experiment that you did?
Well, there was a broad set. We had five different sets.
Okay.
And they also included a set where we had birth control and a drug that would reduce the effectiveness of birth control. So we hit a big range here.
Yeah, so some that were deadly and some that maybe would just make it not as effective. And did you look into things like the hours pharmacists were working that might have led to some of these errors? And do we know, I mean, you mentioned specific examples of patients who were harmed. Do we know how widespread that is?
Well, we do know that it is a problem and that there are thousands of people that go to the hospital each year because of dangerous combinations that they take. We do know from talking to pharmacists and from looking at internal records of pharmacies during our investigation that a lot of times the chains in particular will put a lot of pressure on the pharmacists. They're cutting back on the pharmacy assistants through technicians. And they're still expecting pharmacists to make calls to make sure somebody didn't miss their prescription or to, in some cases, press different types of sales at the store. And so they have a lot of different duties on top of things like flu shots, too. And distractions are one element of it, but the fact that so many prescriptions are coming in, it's a type of assembly line type of process. And we understood that some pharmacists don't even eat or drink water during their shift for fear that they'll have to take a break to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, I want to hear more from that. I want to bring in Dr. Lakeisha Butler. She's a pharmacist and professor at Southern Illinois University in Edwardsville. Dr. Butler, as Ray's describing these things, I wonder if you can chime in and share how demanding is the job of a pharmacist in terms of hours, and how does it compare to other jobs in the medical field?
Absolutely. So we're certainly talking about community pharmacy and their variety of pharmacy career options that one can go into if they're pursuing pharmacy. Community pharmacy is certainly one of the highest demanding or just high energy, stress level compared to other careers in pharmacy. And it oftentimes will depend on the prescription volume that is filled at that store. And so there are some stores, some pharmacies that will fill less prescriptions, and therefore the demand is less and the stress level is less. But I would certainly echo what's been stated. It's the demand of these metrics, or what we may call key performance indicators, KPIs, that can really play a part in putting this extreme demand on the pharmacist. And so keeping up with the metrics of getting as many prescriptions filled, and doing them in a way that certainly increases the numbers and revenue. You know, one of my thoughts is if we can decrease the demand on those pharmacists as it relates to the metrics and getting back to the true essence of pharmacy being the most accessible healthcare professional, that certainly would be an ideal practice.
Yeah, and Dr. Butler, I wanted to ask you, as Ray was describing, you know, patients coming in with combinations of drugs that could be dangerous or even deadly, are doctors supposed to catch that, or is that on pharmacists to do that?
That's a great question, and that's something that I was noting. Certainly, the prescribers are supposed to be the first line as it relates to prescribing the right medications and making sure that they're not drug-drug interactions or even drug-disease interactions. Pharmacists are really kind of that last check to ensure that the patient does not get something that may be harmful. But I would agree that it would be both the responsibility of the prescriber, which would be the physician or another prescriber, and then, of course, the pharmacist. And so we can't necessarily place all of the blame on the pharmacist, which I totally agree. We are trained to make sure that we are checking for those different interactions. But certainly the prescriber is that first check.
Yeah, and pharmacists have a very specialized training with advanced degrees. They do much more than just put pills into bottles. Dr. Butler, can you talk a little bit about more specifically the role that pharmacists play in a patient's care?
Absolutely. So we are certainly the drug experts. We receive number of hours. So pharmacists are receiving a doctorate degree and at least 4 years of pharmacy school. They have to have 4 years of pharmacy school and at least 2 years of pre-pharmacy. With being the drug expert, they are learning how to make patient-specific pharmacotherapy plans, but not only just related to the prescriptions that you get behind the counter, but also any kind of non-pharmacologic plan. So making sure that lifestyle modifications are in place and over-the-counter medications don't interact. We can even discuss things regarding their diet and how that may come into play with their disease states. And so these pharmacy students, over the course of those 4 years, they get hundreds of hours of pharmacotherapy training, and so that they are able to truly come up with the best plan for the patient.
And all of that you described, it kind of depends on having the time to do that. Like if you're overworked or if you're having so many prescriptions to fill, there may not be capacity for that, I imagine.
Absolutely. When you're needing to check or if you're being pulled in so many directions that was stated earlier, that can get your mind off balance and you're not necessarily focused in on what might be the task at hand.
We're speaking with Dr. Lakeisha Butler. She's a pharmacist and professor of pharmacy at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. We're also joined by Ray Long, reporter with the Chicago Tribune. Ray, let's come back to you just for a minute and get into some of the recent developments following the Tribune investigation into these kinds of pharmacy errors. So I want to learn about legislation, but first, have private companies like Walgreens or CVS taken their own initiative to implement changes to curb errors?
Yeah, at least a half a dozen major chains have taken steps, they say, that have tightened their internal controls to try to do things that will catch the errors better, including training and reprogramming computers to try to make sure that they're flagging the combinations that are most dangerous. Also, Governor Rauner, the former governor, once our report came out, pushed for and successfully pushed through regulatory changes that were made administratively in Illinois, where you will now have pharmacists counseling. In other words, you'll see signs at places like Walgreens that say, we'll talk to you about what your prescriptions are, and then they will come out at the end of the day if you have a new prescription or if you have a change in a long-time prescription, and talk to you about those changes and make sure that you're taking that that drug with others that are not dangerous to combine them
yeah.
with. And so there's that already. But in recent days, we've seen legislation emerge that would give pharmacists breaks. They would require that a pharmacist who works 6 hours gets a half-hour break and a 15-minute break, a half-hour lunch break, 15-minute break. If they go another 6 hours to 12, they'd get another 15-minute break to just give themselves a chance for their mind to reset.
Yeah.
Now, the Teamsters are actually the union representative for some of the pharmacists up here in Chicago area at Osco and CVS at some of those stores, and they are pressing right now to make that an 8-hour day.
Huh.
Their argument is that it's a lot of fatigue that builds up when you're moving hundreds of prescriptions and standing on your
right.
feet all day.
So there's been all this legislative action and more in the works, and you're saying that pharmacists that you've talked with are even saying it still doesn't go far enough. Dr. Butler, as you're hearing this, I'm curious to hear how you feel about these proposed changes in Illinois. Do you think they would make a difference for pharmacists?
I think they're definitely a step in the right direction. I'm certainly all for breaks. I have experience in working as a community pharmacist PRN, and I know oftentimes it was hard just to get away to go use a restroom. And so definitely the mandatory breaks, specifically the 30-minute, because oftentimes if you're trying to get away for just 15 minutes, that might be a challenge if you're not closing down the pharmacy. Things can get backed up. And there's really no way to enforce the 15 minutes unless you close the pharmacy or have someone overlapping. The 30 minutes, we've seen that a couple of pharmacy, community pharmacies are already implementing that across the state. And we're seeing that that's become beneficial, that we have to, of course, inform the public that this is something that we're practicing, because if they're not used to it and they come in and they're wanting their prescription, then that will create some type of anger or, some problems with the patient.
Yeah.
But the one thing that I did want to mention, all patients are required to be offered counseling, but it's not necessarily a common practice. They oftentimes will decline, balancing, with the whole idea of the other demands that they have, but stepping away in counseling if they don't have a support, or if patients aren't just overall used to being able to receive that counseling, that's also an issue. So we have to really get them into the practice of pharmacists are available, including these lines, these signs, and making sure that they understand that we can come out and truly educate you getting in that practice of truly counseling. That's
yeah.
where what we're missing. The patients are offered counseling, but oftentimes they are not necessarily receiving it.
Yeah. And Ray, we just have about a minute left. What are next steps for these changes after this bill is drafted? What comes next?
Well, they're trying to reach a compromise right now on where the legislation is headed. If they can reach a compromise on the number of hours, the bill says you could have a pharmacist work as much as 12 hours. The unions have been pressing for 8. There's an effort to try to negotiate a compromise in there, and that could emerge as soon as next week. If it does not emerge as soon as next week, they still need to renew the Basic Pharmacy Act, the one that says you can practice pharmacy in Illinois. So that will be pushed through, and they'll just continue to pick up and try to negotiate the rest of the potential changes later on in subsequent legislation.
That was WILL health reporter Christine Herman speaking with Chicago Tribune reporter Ray Long and Dr. Lakeisha Butler, a clinical associate professor of pharmacy at Southern Illinois University. Coming up, recreational weed in Illinois has been legal for months now. We revisit a conversation with a historian about how it compares to the end of alcohol prohibition in the early 20th century. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Recreational weed in Illinois was legalized on January 1st of this year, and some historians were reminded of a time nearly a century ago when another substance, alcohol, was no longer prohibited for those old enough to partake. Today, we're revisiting a conversation with Garrett Peck, author of The Prohibition Hangover, Alcohol in America from Demon Rum to Cult Cabaret, and Isaac Campos, an associate professor of history at the University of Cincinnati. He's the author of Homegrown, Marijuana and the Origins of Mexico's War on Drugs. They spoke with WILL's Christine Herman back in January about some little-known weed history. Here is that interview.
Garrett, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks so much. And I love the fact that the show is called the 21st because that kind of ties in with the 21st Amendment, which repealed prohibition.
Oh, interesting. So our tagline is 21st century radio for the 21st state. Illinois is the 21st state. And that's another tidbit I was not aware of. Thanks for pointing that out. So, Garrett, most of the stories we know from the alcohol prohibition today, almost 90 years after it ended, are about organized crime, bootleggers, speakeasies. So we know that when alcohol was illegal, people drank it anyways. And likewise, millions of Americans have smoked cannabis when it was illegal in Illinois way back in December of 2019. Obviously, it's still illegal federally. Do you think states are striking down their cannabis prohibitions for the same reasons the alcohol prohibition ended?
I think that is part of it. Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you look back to the Obama years, as public opinion was swinging towards legalization, the Obama administration basically said, you know what, we're going to stay out of this because there was really no political gain to get involved. You know, we'd fought this war on drugs since the Richard Nixon era. And it's like, okay, is this winnable? What's this really getting us? And I think with the Obama administration, their willingness to take a hands-off approach meant that states could kind of make their own decisions. And thus you're seeing, you know, first medical marijuana followed by actual legalization. And it's just simply guided by the fact that people want to do this.
And it's also, I mean, illegal alcohol was hard to regulate. And so there were also dangerous things that were happening. Is that similar to illegal cannabis and how there could be certain risks with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, we know that cannabis over, you know, since the hippie era, you know, the 1960s, 1970s, cannabis has certainly got a lot stronger. It's much more potent today. And I think one of the things you could argue about legalization is that consumers have a right to know what they're putting under their bodies. And thus, like through legalization, you can know what the THC level is, et cetera. And, you know, during prohibition, if you were buying bootleg gin, you know, it might actually be renatured industrial alcohol with some juniper flavoring in it. So you had no idea as a consumer what you're buying. And the same thing, of course, for cannabis. If you're buying it from a dealer, is this actually, you know, grade A Humboldt County, or is this something, you know, from a lesser dealer and it's actually mostly oregano seeds, et cetera? You know, you really have no idea what you're buying because it's not regulated.
Yeah. Yesterday, one of our producers spoke with some university students in Illinois, and some of them said that legal recreational cannabis sold at Illinois dispensaries is more expensive than what they can get on the street. So while they don't need to fear repercussions, now if they get caught carrying weed, it raises questions whether legalization will make a dent in the black market. I wonder, did bootlegging and home brewing persist after the end of alcohol prohibition?
They sure did, yeah. And certainly, for example, moonshining, that still continues to this day. But gradually over time, it has diminished overall as more and more players got tired of getting arrested for producing moonshine and not paying taxes on it. And that was a big factor in the demise of the industry. So, yeah, over time, I think you'll see more people step into the light of regulation, but it takes time.
And I'd be curious, Garrett, to know how might we look back on this history of states now legalizing cannabis? What parallels do you think we'll find between alcohol legalization and the different cannabis legalization efforts we're seeing across the country, including here in Illinois?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. So I guess part of it's just going to take some time to see how, well, in part how nostalgic people get about it. There's always so much propaganda about it. I remember in 2008, which was the 75th anniversary of repeal of prohibition, and you saw all these, you know, people started calling them speakeasies. You know, fake speakeasies were opening up, and bartenders are coming out there with twirly mustaches and suspenders and so on. In other words, people were getting very nostalgic about history, which is always a little, I'm a little cautious about that. The people who were bootleggers and whatnot, they weren't freedom fighters. They were, in fact, breaking the law. But we can certainly overlook that with like, oh, wow, weren't there some great cocktails that came about from that time? So I would caution the same thing here as well around cannabis legalization. You know, we all kind of like laugh at seeing the movie Reefer Madness and so on, which is a propaganda movie. But certainly things can go the other direction where we can make it look like cannabis is going to solve all of our problems. And it certainly won't.
Garrett Peck is the author of The Prohibition Hangover, Alcohol in America from Demon Rum to Cult Cabernet. Thank you so much, Garrett, for joining us on the 21st.
Thank you, Christine.
And to get another historical perspective on cannabis prohibition and legalization, let's go now to Isaac Campos. He's a professor of history at the University of Cincinnati and the author of Homegrown: Marijuana and the Origins of Mexico's War on Drugs. Isaac, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So for the past century or so, recreational cannabis use in America has become closely associated with Mexican and immigrants. The word marijuana, after all, is borrowed from Mexican Spanish. Can you talk a little bit about how that association even came to be here in the U.S.?
Sure. Well, so cannabis, intoxicant cannabis, has been known in the United States since the middle of the 19th century, so the 1840s, 1850s. But in the 1890s, Mexican ideas about this same drug, but with a different name called marijuana, began to filter into the United States. So recreational cannabis hadn't been used in Mexico much longer than it had been used in the U.S., so it dates to about, again, the mid-19th century. But in Mexico, the use had developed a much more sinister and a much more widespread reputation by the end of the century. So in the 1890s, marijuana in Mexico was closely associated with madness and violence. I mean, those two things are overwhelmingly associated with marijuana use in Mexico. And in the 1890s, kind of sensationalistic newspaper stories about this drug and those effects begin to spread into the United States from the Mexican media and the Mexican press. So that's when you first start seeing the word marijuana in the United States. And it's essentially kind of an organic process, basically, where just Mexican ideas are starting to spread into the U.S. And it's through these kinds of stories that marijuana starts to be associated with Mexico, because, again, the word comes from Mexico, and these stories were coming from Mexico. And also during that period, the typical way that Mexicans used marijuana also becomes common in the U.S., perhaps because Mexicans introduced it, or perhaps because of word of mouth, and that is smoking cannabis in cigarettes. Smoking marijuana and cigarettes, that starts to become more common, whereas in the U.S. people had tended to eat chunks of hashish, or what was called Indian hemp, prior to that. And so it's in the early, it's in that period from about the 1890s to you know, 1920s, where the drug comes to be associated with Mexico and Mexicans.
And that had a lot to do with some of the efforts that led to ultimately make it illegal, right? There were people in federal officials who worked to kind of draw on some of that, those sensationalistic news stories you were talking about, right? To perhaps incite like fear.
Yeah, I think that's part of it, though. I think that sometimes is overplayed to our detriment today, because the argument that early marijuana prohibition was essentially just an excuse to persecute Mexican immigrants or some other form of racism at the time, while there is some truth in those stories, it also tends to diminish the fact that there were also people who were calling for the regulation of cannabis and other drugs in the early 20th century, because these are recreational substances that can be abused, right? And there were some people who had negative outcomes from the use of these drugs. They're not, none of these drugs are harmless, whether we're talking about caffeine or cannabis or cocaine, right?
Sure.
And so there were people already prior to those Mexican ideas becoming common in the U.S., and sometimes without even any knowledge of those Mexican ideas, who were pushing for more regulation of cannabis in the U.S. because, interestingly, one reason was is that they saw the manufacturers of different kinds of intoxicant drugs like cannabis or morphine or cocaine exploiting the public by putting them in medicines without their knowledge and that kind of thing. And so there was already a movement afoot in the late 19th century in the U.S. to put more regulations on the distribution of drugs, kind of like we've had here more recently with OxyContin and drugs like that, where it was seen that the pharmaceutical industry was exploiting the public and people wanted more regulations. Well, that was going on in the late 19th century, too. So that's also part of the story. So I would really emphasize that. And And I want to emphasize that just because I think it's I think we want to avoid suggesting that cannabis is somehow harmless, which it's not. No intoxicant is. And it's important, particularly under these new legalization regimes like you have there in Illinois, to keep that in mind.
And kind of related to that, Isaac, I wanted to hear your thoughts on what are the ways you see perhaps both sides of this cannabis legalization debate perhaps doing things to try to attempt to rewrite history in order to support their arguments. Can you share a little about that?
Yeah, well, so most of the writing about cannabis's history in the United States really begins in the late 60s and 1970s. It's actually usually written not by historians but by sociologists and legal scholars who were interested in kind of the current scene in the 70s and trying to understand how it was that cannabis had become illegal when it seemed to be a drug that was no more harmful than alcohol and probably less harmful, and why were people going to jail for this drug when you can, drink a martini at lunch if you want. And so people started looking into this, and they kind of began with the assumption that there must have been something nefarious that occurred in the early 20th century. And so this is how we got our first wave of scholarship, which put an emphasis on in some parts of the scholarship on the racism associated with, Mexicans and marijuana, also put some emphasis on, as you alluded to earlier, federal bureaucrats who perhaps had, manufactured ideas about this drug or promoted some of the more fanciful ideas about its effects and that kind of thing. And those ideas were really important in helping along the debate for marijuana law reform, which has reached now legalization in many parts of the country. And I think that in general is a good thing. Though I think sometimes, as I was suggesting before, I think that's gone a little too far. And so now some of us are pushing back against the way this history has been told. I'm not pushing back against legalization, but I do think that the way we've talked about the history has been flawed. And so now we're pointing out, well, no, actually there were reasons that people, had serious concerns about the use of cannabis in the early 20th century. And no, there were good reasons to actually pursue some kind of regulation. And now we find that sometimes the opponents of legalization are trying to use this new scholarship to and kind of bend it to their needs to suggest that, well, you see, marijuana was causing madness and violence in the early 20th century and that kind of thing. It's always a little scary when people start using your research for their political motives.
Sure.
But I do think it's really important to understand this history, because I think what we're trying to do now is we're trying to find that tricky middle point between total prohibition, which we know has also many negative effects and, in fact, ends up causing more problems than it solves, and total lack of regulation, which in the late 19th, early 20th century, we also saw led to the exploitation of a lot of the public, led to a lot of bad public health outcomes. So we're trying to find some, that tricky middle balance point between total prohibition and no regulation at all.
So you're a historian who really knows a lot about this, and I'm curious to know where you would bring that balance. What would be the best balance in your view? We just have about a minute left here.
Yeah, sure. Well, in my view, I think people should have access to cannabis, so it shouldn't be prohibited. On the other hand, in a perfect world, the sale of it would be controlled probably by the state, by some kind of monopoly, so that corporations and private interests would not have an interest in promoting addiction and promoting overuse, because private interests inevitably end up having an interest in getting people to use more. And I think that historically has always been a problem with the sale of intoxicants. So a system where you can get access to the drug, but we don't allow the promotion of the use of the drug to a great extent.
That was Christine Herman speaking with Isaac Gompos, an associate professor of history at the University of Cincinnati and author of Homegrown, Marijuana and the Origins of Mexico's War on Drugs. That's all the time we have for today. Follow us on Twitter. Search for The 21st Show. We tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you would want us to ask on air. All of those links and every other way to contact us. If you would like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, just go to our website, 21stshow.org. We've also got all of our past shows there. You can also find us most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify now, as well as Apple Podcasts and NPR One. Search for The 21st. We're produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Eunice Alpazon is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Reginald Hardwick. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thank you for listening.